Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, episode 2, May the 18th, reading on, and obviously the objective for me is to read and memorize details to go forward. Okay, a simple experiment could help find alien life on Europa by Jonathan Coughlin. Finding amino acids on other worlds could be a sign of life there, but only if we can be sure they were produced by living things. The subsurface oceans of icy moons such as Jupiter's Europa and Saturn's Enceladus might contain amino acids, but they can also be made by non-biologically. How can we tell them apart? One thing, well, the biological ones tend to be of one chirality. That would help is to rule out the presence of primordial amino acids created when the solar system formed, when life wasn't found. These have been found on comets. Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins and chemistry and life as we know it. So amino acids is the carbon with an amine, carbon with a side change, carbon with an oxygen, and the oxygen goes to an oxygen OH to make an acid. And so that links together. Says Nok Tong of Cornell University in New York, quote, if amino acids can be found in the ocean of Europa, they could be relics of primordial synthesis process. In laboratory experiments, Tong and his colleagues found that some amino acids, aspartic acid from asparaguses, and threonine in particular, could only be in warm, hydrothermically active oceans of icy moons if they were produced in the past million years. Or whatever that means. This means that if any detected, they would probably have been produced recently, cosmologically speaking, which means biological origin is possible. This helps us understand the biosignatures we may wish to target for missions in Enceladus. I read that. I've never heard it. And Europa, says Morgan at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. I've got to really get this in my head, what these things are. Machines See Differently by Linda Geddes. We are beginning to grasp why AI is so easily fooled and how to stop it from happening. Like the Chinese going out saying, you Yanks, you can't do this. Your machines can fall over. The US, the Chinese academic force is a lot thinner on the ground as far as I can see. Why did machines think the turtle was a rifle? No, this isn't a bad joke, but it's one that may many of the recent examples of machines being tricked into seeing things that aren't there. Artificial intelligence can easily be confused, so-called, by adversarial images which contain seemingly innocuous changes that don't affect what people see. Like many others, Alexander Madry and Massachusetts Institute of Technology thought this was a bug that would vanish with better algorithms or ways to train the systems. But he and his colleagues have discovered that adversarial images seem to arise from features that we can't perceive, but the machine can. You see, that's interesting. There's that thing of filtering adds clarity. Reducing the light adds clarity. So you can reduce it, can cut out things, and also noise and a signal can also add precision. And this is, I find it an interesting element of electronics that, what I would like to do is, you've got your bin accuracy, but your bin division accuracy is a different thing. That may be another factor of 10 beneath. And if you scan it, you'll get a greater precision. So what I really would like to do is put a vibrating weight up in the top and see how it goes. Okay. Most examples of adversarial images seem baffling to an onlooker. The two pictures that look identical being interpreted in different ways by AI. For instance, two apparently identical images of a cat. An AI will insist one of them is a dog. As a research experiment, fooling AI can be amusing. But if a medical AI misses early obvious tumour in a medical scan, the result could be tragic. Now, Madri and his team appear to have confirmed a long-held suspicion that AI don't view images in a similar way to humans. Rather than relying on details like ear shape or nose length to classify images of animals, they use features which are imperceptible to us. We don't actually know what these features are. They may be big or small, but humans' brains doesn't pick up on them. The team calls them non-robust features because they seem to leave AI particularly vulnerable to adversarial images in which the features have presumably been disrupted to some degree. To identify that non-robust features were partly a problem, Madri team took a standard collection of images of cats and dogs and generated a series of adversarial examples which involved tweaking pixels in each picture. They used trend AI. Rather than resulting in something completely useless, when AI was shown non-adversarial examples, it got them right, meaning non-robust features did help it to correctly identify cats and dogs, just as adversarial images. Researchers then used AI to point out which parts of the image they would focus on. They could then look at these of the images before training another AI on the altered pictures, in effect forcing it to use human methods to make choices. Isn't that amazing? The result of this was an AI with improved resistance to adversarial images, reaching a level usually only seen when painstaking effort is used to correct AI's mistakes. So this is AI correcting AI. So AI operates, you've got its problems, and now it learns from its mistakes, which is what humans do. Understanding this is a good step forward in AI that can be safely deployed in real world, says Pushmikoli, research team of DeepMind. The quote concept of these features is helpful, and it goes some way towards explaining the phenomena, says Mantra Kirathorwalska, the University of Oxford, whoever they are. Yeah, gee, New Scientist is such an interesting magazine. He's really interesting. The search for life's cradle. Scientists are taking a hunt for life's origins out into the open air. Nearly 4 billion years after life arose on Earth, researchers have been trying to recreate the first steps towards life's steamy, bubbling pools in the steamy, bubbling pools of New Zealand. One of the biggest questions is understanding life origins, how small molecules such as fatty acid, nucleotides and amino acids first formed long polymer chains like lipids, RNA and proteins. So fatty acids, this is interesting, there's a fat with an acid end, so the acid end goes to water and they form, it's really interesting. It's not, lipids are more a membrane. Previously, lab experiments by David Dreamer at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and his colleagues have found that basic cell-like structures called protocells can form from conditions in hot springs temperatures, 80 degrees to 90 degrees, by repeated cycles of drying and rehydrations. I think there's that. There's also the fact that they could form inside cracks. The conditions can bring simple molecules together and encourage them to form into long polymer chains essential for life. Yes, I think the thing is that if they form a chain and they don't get, you know, the chain formation, there's chemical conditions to chain formation, and then the path back is slightly different. So it forms and doesn't, and then it forms again, adds a bit more. If lipid molecules are present too, this simulated environment can cause the polymers to become encapsulated in tiny papillary membranes similar to those seen outside of all cells today. To find out if similar results could occur in the real-world conditions, Dreamer's colleagues Bruce Drammer travelled to a geothermal thermal near Rotorua in New Zealand. The acidic, apparently they stink, like it's like going to a bad toilet. The acidic hot springs were like a chemistry experiment that nature is carrying out, says Drammer. He placed glass vials holding a prebiotic soup into a near boiling pool. The mix contained fatty acids and I don't know why he had to actually do it there. It's almost like, and now I'm going to demonstrate this to the public. It's in my lab, but now in this, it's sort of like this Victorian era where it's, you had the discovery, but you had to show it to people. So I can't see why you have to be there, especially if it's on gas vial. It also included two components of the building blocks of RNA, which widely believed to have been life's first genetic material. So RNA, the entire thing of RNA has got the extra hydroxide that makes the molecule very, less, more easily to be rotated and stuck down. It's almost like it's got its own internal glue, so it can actually, an RNA thing can bend and doesn't form, doesn't spring out in a, as a DNA. The pool heated up the soup to 90 degrees. When it dried out, Jeremy repeatedly wet it with highly acidic water from a nearby pool that filtered in, had been filtered to remove any microorganisms. The idea was to mimic water splashes from the gas eruptions, but on a faster timescale and without contamination from existing life. Dried films became visible on the glass of the vial, and subsequent tests revealed that long RNA-like molecules had formed within these fatty layers. Dreamably, this is the first time anyone has tested laboratory results out in a real environment, similar kinds of places that would have existed when life began. Okay, so he could have done all that in his lab, but he decided to do it in the open air to do it. I'm not that impressed. I suppose it is. He says the results are due to be published soon. But John Sutherland of the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology, Canberra, warns that the experiment did not make RNA itself and says it doesn't. Doesn't think that RNA-like polymers that formed are relevant to the origins of life chemistry. It's quite neat work, both, but needs replicating, says Lane University of, University College. The problem is that there's no obviously path for the results to cells that have a metabolism that can be reproduced themselves, he says, which is what a cell is. The magnetism of the universe is very, very weak, which is Chelsea White. Now, given that magnetism is the electric field with a, is frame dependent electric field, it says the electric field of the universe is very weak. Sort of what it does mean. I just find it's hard to, and we are traveling with respect to the Big Bang. The magnetism of the entire universe is 2.5 billion times less as strong as the fridge magnet, according to an analysis. The magnetic field is weak by standards, but it's a lot of energy. There's as much energy in the Milky Way in magnetism as there is in starlight, says Baron Gresher, University of Toronto in Canada. As light passes through a magnetic field, the Faraday effect causes the like orientation or polarization to rotate. I think the Faraday effect has to be in a Faraday crystal. I don't know if there's a Faraday effect on volume, not on, on vacuum. Let's see what they say, because I think if there is a Faraday effect and there's some sort of absorption going on, the light is held for a while and then re-released at an angle. It cacks in a thing and then bounces around and inside an atom and moves around. There's no way. So the space doesn't have a geometrical handle to rotate it. Unless I really don't understand it, see what they're saying. They searched through the catalogues of polarized light sources in the universe. Conveniently, these frequencies occur in pairs because galaxies often have a supermassive black hole at their center shooting out twin jets of radiation in opposite directions, making them easy to identify. They're like two searchlights that light up the magnetic field. Mm-hmm. He and his colleagues used 317 of these pairs to calculate the strength of magnetic field, these spots. Some magnetism we see that the light comes from the matter in the galaxy itself, but some is added as the light travels to us through the intergalactic medium. To separate this out, this element, the scene compared 511 other pairs of polarized light sources that were both coming from the same direction, but with one that was double or triple the distance from us than the nearest source. Okay, so I can see that. It's just, is the intergalactic medium a vacuum? And does a magnetic field in a vacuum create polarization shift? It's just, yeah, I just find that mentally hard to get my mind around. The longer the light travels through space, the bigger the Faraday effect. So the team subtracted the magnetic field readings for the nearest sources to calculate the input from the galactic medium. The upper limit of the universe magnetism is found to be 40 nanogauss. A fridge magnet has... that's the upper limit. Gee, I'm just not not impressed with that. I just can't work it out. Yeah, if there is any matter in deep space, that matter definitely will interact with the light and pull it back. And if it's got a magnetic field, it will rotate it. Many people who use voice assistants may be less likely to understand a woman, Nicole Cobe. Many women who use the device of the voice assistant, yes, but 100 years from now, I don't think that's going to be a problem, but let's listen. Many people who use the device of the voice assistant, such as Amazon Echo or Google Home, have endured them not fully grasping commands, but it appears they may be worse at understanding commands than women than men. That is interesting, because men have to give commands in hunting, whereas women, the commands are much more subtle. Polling company YouGov asked 1,000 people in the UK about their voice assistants. About 2/3 of the female participants said the software had failed to respond to their voice commands some of the time, compared to half of the men. Well, that's a reporting bias, isn't it? Now, this is ironic, given most of the smart speakers are designed to have female voices, says Russell Fidman Fuga. As the survey was self-reported, it may not be entirely match reality. Yeah, surely you'd be able to pick this up. Yeah, it says Trevor Cox of the University of Salford, UK, to confirm the results, the test should be run with different voices and different speech recognition systems, he says. Early studies have suggested gender does affect the accuracy of speech recognition. Rachel Tatman, while at the University of Washington, found YouTube's captioning system uses similar technology, was less accurate for women than men. She later discovered that much of the difference had disappeared when controlling for sound quality, suggesting that it may work less well if women are in noisy situations, i.e. the men are just there with their pipe doing nothing much, and women are clashing dishes and stuff like that. Separate research found that analysing speech from men and women differently could increase the accuracy. Similar accuracy gaps are seen with dialect and ethnicity. If a speech recognition system is trained on fewer examples of female voice or other dialects, it may be worse at processing them, says Maureen Barner of the Swinburne University of Technology Australia. Most big technology companies have not publicly revealed the range of voices they've used to develop such tools. Yeah, but what's interesting is that, yeah, it's just bizarre. There's so many things. The renewable revolution is stalling. The UK has the longest coal-fired period since 1882, but don't celebrate yet, says Michael Lepage. So they have gas is going up and down here. There must be winter peaks. Nuclear is supplying a base load. Then after biomass, a nice base load. Large hydro, nothing. Green import, so the import, the technology, gas is, wind is just sort of not doing it, but there's this nice seasonal one, a solar is big when, solar seems to be huge when there's a huge demand for gas. I don't quite understand how this goes. We should be thrilled that for the first time in the century, the UK went more than a week without using any coal to make electricity. While some, so where's coal in here? This is coal-free per day. There's no coal at all. And so at some time they use, you can see that solar is very good, because solar turns on when the gas has to turn on. It's pretty amazing. But wind is just all over the place, and imports it necessary to do it up. For one thing, renewables supplied only 23% of the electricity during the coal-free period, with 45% coming from natural gas. What's more, the UK is veering off track when it comes to meeting long-term targets for cutting greenhouse gas emissions, as is the entire world. Generating electricity without burning fossil fuels is relatively easy. It's much harder to heat homes, make cement and steel, grow food and power cars, ships and planes without producing greenhouse gases. So if we're struggling with the easy part, what's the chance do we have of doing the hard stuff? Let us start with the UK. In the past decade, the country has gone from getting 1/3 of its electricity from coal from obtaining more than 1/3 from renewables. On average, coal is expected to provide only 1% of the electricity this year and should be phased out by 2025. that isn't quite as brilliant as it seems. The UK now gets 11% of electricity from renewable biomass, much of which is used by importing wood. Forest campaigners say swapping coal for wood isn't truly renewable and is doing huge damage to the environment. Even the UK's Committee on Climate Change says large-scale electricity generation for biomass is a bad idea. Wood should be used for things like buildings, it says so. Its carbon remains locked away at the UK until the building burns. The UK has now stopped most of the subsidies that drove the renewables revolution that is still vetoing the cheapest form of renewable power of onshore wind. While I just think the UK, you'd see Vera doodling around the moors and have a huge, I don't think, the UK is too small for wind, is my sort of view. And then it's much better to do offshore. I'd say much better offshore if they do it for the UK, because it's such a small place. Put a wind turbine, it'll just wreck the whole country. But it's UK, you can hide them away. The global renewables, putting a wind turbine on Rocknest Island was, what the heck? I mean, it sort of makes sense. It's so difficult to get energy there. Oh, look. These little birds attacking a big bird here. The global revolution seems also to be stalling. The International Energy Agency recently announced that the world added 180 gigawatts of capacity, solar, wind, and hydropower and bioenergy in 2018, the same as it did in 2017. It says we must add 300 gigawatts a year to have a chance of limiting global warming to under 2 degrees Celsius by 2010. These 2018 data are deeply worrying, but smart, determined policies can get renewable capacities additions back on the upward trend. I'll tell you, the real issue, as far as I understand, is that there is a certain capacity for cheap renewable, which is not intelligent, whereas the actual coal and gas is intelligent. They can provide reactive power, so the reactants is where the current and the voltage is different. But now, if you want to add more power, you're now having to replace the same cost but more costly bits of coal. Let's see how it goes. Okay. That said, IEA Director Faith Brillol in a statement, there is some debate about the IEA figures. They include only power production that was being verified and confirmed. By contrast, research service by Bloomberg NEF figures include estimates of unconfirmed additions, and it says that solar grew 10% globally in 2018. This is still a slowdown compared with 30% growth seen in the past, says Jenny Chase, head of the solar at Bloomberg NEF. It's hard to grow a big number, she says. Yeah, which I sort of can understand. Like if it's doubled, then the 30%, 10% is actually 20% of, the same capacity. It follows a separate report last year said the investment in renewables, it was falling in almost countries except China. Now China too is getting back. Many climate activists have promoted the idea that falling costs of renewables will mean inevitably take over from fossil fuels, even without government help. But if electricity prices don't stay high enough for investors, we'll take their money elsewhere. So we should cheer the end of coal, but continue to worry about how it will be replaced. Yeah, it's very interesting. It's also interesting about gas. And gas seems such a perfect thing to do. But I think we should have nuclear, is my view. Okay. Virtual reality, near-perfect shot. Headsets are letting directors test unlikely camera angles on set. Wearing virtual reality headset, I'm immersed in a speakeasy bar in the 1920s, a strange-looking wooden protagonist played by a human actor whose footage has just been recorded, chit-chats with a computer-generated patron. The technology I'm testing has been created by media company Technicolor. Oh, which is Technicolor. Hmm. It allows film directors to instantly see what the scene would look like if a computer-generated imagery is added in. With a touch of a joystick, I can fly around the set and get a different point of view of the perfect shot, or shrink myself to relative to the scene, Alice in Wonderland style, where a jazz band is in the corner of the bar, seeming quaint, When viewed from above, its brass player now fills the entire frame. Viewed from below, he looks huge and intimidating. In the past, directors had to send footage to special effects studios for the collection of powerful computers and known as render farms. These would add graphical elements in the process, a process taking hours and days. Now directors can put on a VR headset powered by a stack of chips originally designed for video gaming and immediately see how the scene would look if the effects added in. The system means the director can be immersed in the 3D world of visual scenes and seek out the most interesting camera angles. Rather than placing an order for the effects to be added after shooting the scene, directors are serving it up for themselves, says John Brennan of the University of Southern California. The technique is increasingly common with visual effects-heavy films. Steven Spielberg was the early adopter in Ready Player One. Steven was crawling around on the ground to frame shots in VR, says Joe Henderson of Technicolor. Gee, he must be pretty old by now. Similar methods have been used for the recent remake of The Jungle Book and the upcoming new version of Lion King. Can I say, don't you actually sense that we are just sort of putting, I don't know, spack filler on The Last Supper? You know, cracks in The Last Supper. I don't think we're really adding that much if we're doing redoing The Jungle Screen and The New Lion King. The technology, but look, isn't The Jungle Book and The Lion King fake anyway? Technology can reduce the bill of visual effects by 15% to 20%, says independent filmmaker Kevin Margo. Thank you. Margo cobbled together his own virtual production system with a flat panel screen in front of his face to shoot Construct, a short film about humanoid robots. He says his method can make directors more creative because they can see visual effects immediately. High-powered VR headsets are still mostly a niche product as they are pricey, you betcha. Los Angeles, says Nancy Richardson of the University of California, Los Angeles. The cost of a high-end system can easily reach $10,000. Out of the reach of low-budget films, but relatively minor expense for a blockbuster. Evolution by Jake Bueller. Non-native birds introduced to Hawaii evolved in mere decades. I may have said that. Non-native birds are adapting to... Now, I'm just going to stop here and see if I can do a review. Did I do the moons? The moons of biology and the moons of Jupiter. I did the AI shot. I did the heating. And what else is there? Just go back. Machines see differently. Okay. Most of the native fruit-eating birds in the Hawaiian archipelago have gone extinct. These birds were important for dispersing fruit seeds on the island of Oahu, and is mostly done by non-native birds. Jason Griffiths of the University of Illinois of Urbana-Champaign and his colleagues have been studying these changes have affected the island. They found that, despite the loss of native fruit eaters, also still has a complex functioning ecosystem, possibly thanks to the birds' rapid evolution of the non-native birds to fill niches vacated by the loss of endemic species. Why are the endemic species being carked down? To see whether the introduced birds have been evolving in Oahu, Gertz and his team colleague Janelle Sperry compared four non-native songbird species on the island, including the red-billed Leothrix, with the museum specimens collected from their native ranges. They measured the birds' bills, tails, legs, and wings. So you can see the bias for museums. They found that in Hawaii, these birds have undergone physical changes of up to 13% in some measurements. Compared with native range specimens, two specimens have significantly shorter legs, and most had larger, thicker bills, shorter wings, longer tails. Four species studies were introduced between 50 and 90 years ago. Evolution is typically thought to occur in millennia. We're talking about 10 to 20 generations at most, but statistical analysis suggests the bird's evolution is possibly only partially shaped by adapting to the life on the island. Founder effects may also be at work. These evolutionary phenomena involve a genetic mix of a small starting population propagating a species to evolve changes that aren't necessarily beneficial or adaptive. And I could say that for sure. I could say that for sure. It's so hard to get rid of that. Okay. Dark depths look full of colour to fish eyes. Some animals living in the deep oceans have evolved highly sensitive eyes which can see a range of colours hues in near blackness. The big surprise, this is a big surprise, quote, says Susanna Musilova of the University of Basel in Switzerland. She sounds, Susanna, it's double Z, she, wow. Quote, they have more sensitive eyes and can see better than humans in lower light. Well, Zavant, which you bloody well think so. Like, imagine I was stuck at the bottom of the ocean. First thing, I get very bored, very cold, and, you know, what's on telly? It's too much. Musilova and her team collected DNA from 26 species of fish that live more than 200 metres below the surface. Analysing this DNA found that 6 species carried additional genes for rod osprin, a light-sensitive protein that enables the retina cells to detect light. Well, that's done it. You've nailed it, sunshine. Vertebrate animals are used rod osprin to detect light in dim environments, but most species, including humans, only have one rod osprin gene. However, adult silver spiny fins, a flat fish that lives at depths of 2,000 meters, have 38 of them. Well, that's nailed it. The team translated the genes into proteins in a dish and shone light at different wavelengths onto them. Okay, so they would have put them in a bacterium. They found that the osprins detect a wide range of colours and are especially sensitive to green-blue light, nonetheless. We believe we can detect more shades of blue and green than us. She says having highly sensitive eyes may be useful for detecting glowing bioluminescence emitted by deep-sea creatures. Now remember, 70% of funguses glow in the dark. These bioluminescence lights are mostly blue-green in colour. Well, one to say blue and green. Blue-green in number, blue-green in weight. Being able to tell colours apart could help fish distinguish whether a flash comes from a predator or prey, Musilova says. Here we go. Damming of rivers has left precious few in a natural state. I'm just not going to remember what I've read here. I think, I've got it back. I'll just have to remember the moons, the coal, something to do with AI vision. Damming, I think, have I read that one? I don't know, it's coming up. Birds in Hawaii, perfect shot. Search for life's cradle. Weak magnetism. Voice assistance, renewables. Amazing how my brain's a sieve. Okay, nearly 2/3 of the world's longest rivers have had their flows impeded by humans in the form of dams, reservoirs, and other water engineering. Imagine the Nile. What's happening? The Nile's happening. Oh, no, we're hitting there's one. I mean, they haven't dammed the Amazon just quite yet. A boom in hydropower is partly to blame, suggesting the pursuit of renewable energy may be putting fragile habitats at risk. Gunther Grill of McGill, University of Canada, and his colleagues spent a decade analysing over 300,000 watercourses, producing the most detailed global assessment yet of the long, free-flowing rivers. They found that they have become increasingly rare, confined to remote regions such as the Arctic or Congo Basin. Of the 246 rivers that are 1,000 kilometres or longer, they found that just 90 are still free-flowing. 8 of these are in the Amazon Basin. Well, there you go. A big driver of this has seen tapping rivers for electricity generation, a strategy many Asian countries have pursued recently. I just admit, it just makes me weep to see Indonesia going hydro because they've got obviously a small catchment. They're small islands, so it's a small catchment area. So they've got huge rain. It's just the devastation is just unforgivable. It was all funded by Chinese government. We should care about free-flowing rivers because these benefits, they provide humans with wildlife and allow exchange of nutrient sediments and species. You blood oath. They are among the most biodiverse habitats in the world, giving them a relatively small habitat space. They are very fragile to human alterations, said Adam Vaughan. By Chelsea White, wasps are the first insect logicians. Logical reasoning is complex behaviour, which has often been thought to be limited to animals which have complex nervous systems. But it appears wasps, what about mold? Sorry, I don't know what they're talking about. What about my favourite slime mold? But it appears wasps can be used a kind of logic deduction that's first, that's the first of such findings in invertebrates. Type of reasoning is called surely a octopus is an invertebrate. Okay. Type of reasoning is called transitive interference and is some people do easily. If you know A is bigger than B and B is bigger than C, then you know that A is bigger than C. Elizabeth Tithetz of the University of Michigan and her team put 40 paper wasps individually to show in a shallow regular container. These boxes had different colours at each end, and 5 colours were used in total, each corresponding to A to E. In any combination, the colour that was linked to the latter letter in the alphabet was rigged to give a wasp an electric shock if they stood on it. Good old shock. After trials of encountering 4 colours, the pair responded, adapted to adjacent letters A to B, B to C, so it would know to avoid. So the one that you always say be good is E, and the one that would always be B is A. This is the thing. In scenarios, they would use logic to work out the order of letters to avoid getting an electric shock. Overall, 65% of the wasps managed to correctly choose B over D, which is a better chance. Oh, that is just the worst science I've ever seen. Okay. Meditation linked to anxiety and fear. A survey of 1,232 people who regularly meditate, over a quarter said they have experienced negative mental states as a result of the practice. People were more likely to report this if they used only types of deconstructive meditation, which typically involve contemplating the nature of conscious experience. What the heck? Oh, no, this is interesting. No, I don't quite understand this. Okay, benefit of dung spread far and wide. Penguins and seals' feces can help organisms that are kilometres away. Analysis of vegetation in Antarctica found that the nitrogen from penguin poo and seal waste could spread to areas 240 times the size of the colony, providing vital nutrients to plants and small creatures, i.e. they don't stay in their own way. Progesterone boosts birth rate. A hormone may increase live births among women who previously had miscarriage and bleeding during pregnancy. A study linked progesterone with treatment with 5.5% increase in births among such women. Well, thank you very much for that. Technology. Using Uber may worsen traffic jams. Self-hailing Uber services, Uber and Lyft, don't seem to have lived up to their claims of reducing traffic delays. In San Francisco, use of these services increases congestion by 40% between 2010 and 2016, according to the study. Greg Gatto of the University of Kentucky and his colleagues were able to work out how many Uber and Lyft, L-Y-F-T, trips were taken and their start and finish points. They found out the effect of these trips on traffic in the city. The team turned to a simulation used by transport planners to forecast the road by taking into account population growth, employment rates, construction, new roadways and public transit, as you would. The version they used was calibrated in 2010, before Uber and Lyft were widely used, which offered a chance to forecast what traffic would have been like without these services and then compare with the real-world data. They found that Uber and Lyft were the largest contributors to the increase in traffic congestion in San Francisco between these 2 dates. Extra cars and disruptions to curbside pickups and drop-offs increased the total hours on the road and delays in the city by 62%. Without Uber and Lyft in the simulation, the delay grew by only 22%, meaning the services accounted for 40%. Both services questioned their finding. It overlooks notable contributors to congestion, says Lyft rival. Services Uber points out that the studies disagree with the cause, disagree on the cause of congestion. This is such a stupid article. It's a great yarn. Lifted creations that can move. Cuddly soft toys and furnishings are getting an upgrade to make them more like robots. Lee Albert and at the Carnegie Mellon University, in Pittsburgh, and her colleagues have been knitting machines to create moving children's toys and other objects. These include a toy robot that gives a hug when pressed, a jumper with a soft-moving sleeve, and a lampshade that changes shape when given a tug pictured. It looks absolutely awful. Silk strands are knitted into the fabric as part of the process. These strands function as tendons, enabling the object to move certain ways when pulled, such as curving and forming an S-shaped bend. The team called the approach 4D knitting. The technique could be used to make cost-effective wearables. It also is an ideal approach for making soft robots, says, because its wide availability of fabrics and colours. Researchers also experimented in conductive yarns that could be knitted into objects to add smart sensors, blah, 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 that can detect stretching or being touched. Their work was presented at the Human Factors and Computing Systems Conference at Glasgow, UK, 41 minutes. A conference in Glasgow, UK. There's plenty more uranium in the sea. Yeah, that's pretty amazing that there's so much uranium in the sea. A sponge that could harvest the metal used to fuel nuclear power plants from ocean water. The easiest way to get uranium now is to mine it. But there's about 5.7.6 million tons that should be relatively simple to dig up, enough to cover the global needs for about a century. But seawater holds more than 1,000 times or 500 times that, making it a potential backup source. Dong Wang Han, University of China, and his colleagues have created a sponge that sucks up uranium, like most sponges do. It is dipped in chemicals that is easily to bond with uranium when dry. After 8 weeks, in a 5-ton tank of seawater, the sponge had absorbed 1.9 milligrams of uranium per gram of sponge. Oh, well, that's actually not so good. That's quite good. A similar yield, but we don't know how much uranium was in the water. This is a similar yield to other methods of harvesting uranium from the ocean, says Sheng Dai at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee. But the sponge is more eco-friendly as it biodegrades better than plastics used in many of those methods, he says. Getting uranium from the sea is more costly than mining it, but that may change. I find it's hard to do. And of course, the thing is, you want to take only uranium out, you don't want to take all the useful ions. A problem born in the USA. Doctors in the UK are concerned about following the US into an opioid crisis, but are preventive measures going too far, says Claire Wilson. Prescription painkillers carrying opioids will soon become, with a warning, UK, can cause addiction. That will definitely turn the addicts off. Oh, no. Oh. The decision announced last month is part of a range of measures the UK taking in reaction to the opioid crisis gripping the US. As medical use of these painkillers in the US has risen, so has the number of people getting hooked on them and graduating into illegal opioids such as heroin. Deaths from opioid overdoses have lowered the country's life expectancy. But pain specialists warn that restricting opioid use too much also risks, as some people have a real need for powerful medicines. Will the UK be able to avoid following the US down this road of new addiction epidemic without leaving people in unnecessary pain?
opioids have always been our most potent pain relievers. They are excellent for helping people in severe but short-term lasting pains, such as a broken bones or, in my case, heart surgery. Because of the potential for addiction, though, doctors tend to be cautious about prescribing them outside the hospital, apart from people with terminal cancer. Yeah. You could come back to me and whinge, are you? You're going to die. Attitude started changing in the 1990s. Pressure was building among doctors to do more to keep people free from pain. Several US medical bodies said that it should become the fifth vital sign, along with pulse, temperature, breathing, and blood pressure. At the same time, US pharmaceutical companies began creating new formulations of existing drugs and heavily promoting these to doctors. The best known is oxycodone, a slow-release opioid manufacturer claimed to be less than 1% risk of addiction. The message was that if you're enlightened, you're going to be different from those stiggy pre-tentacle doctors in the past, says Andrew Codney, the Brandeis University in Boston. The doctors began prescribing more opioids after surgery, then upped the use of these drugs outside the hospital for conditions such as arthritis, back pain, nerve damage, or from diabetes. When someone on opioids for long enough, their brain chemistry changes and the need to take them gets effect. If they try to cut back, the pain amplifies that. High doses of opioids can also cause sedation and feeling of pleasure, so people in withdrawal feel highly agitated. As a result, many in the US began asking the doctors for ever higher doses. If they reached one doctor's limit, they might try another clinician's and topping up from illicit sources. More liberal prescribings meant people had spare pills to sell, fueling the black market. Quote, "It was everybody's medicine's chest," says Coloni. Deaths from opioid overdoses started to climb. Once people are buying pills illegally, there is a temptation to switch to heroin because it's cheaper. Making things worse, there has recently been an influx of new aesthetic opioids such as fentanyl. Yay, I wrote a poem when I was on fentanyl. It was so good. I didn't realise fentanyl was an opioid, of course, which is much more potent and easier to overdose on. Oh dear. Drug dealers began spiking their heroin with fentanyl to make it go further. It has led to public health catastrophe. There have been similar trends in Canada and to some extent Australia. But the picture is very different in the UK and most other European countries. That's slightly down to culture. In North America, people have more control over the medicinal care. In the US, it's also one of few nations where drug firms can advertise prescription medicines directly to the public. The way the UK National Health Service is set up has helped. Everyone registers with a single primary care physician who acts as the gatekeeper, so people can't juggle multiple prescriptions. Quote, "You don't doctor shop," says Claire Greta, a family doctor in London who specialises in addiction. There is a rise in opioid use in the UK and England. Prescriptions have more than doubled since 2000. Look at that, my God. But doctors seem to have taken heed of what's happening across the Atlantic. Both in 2017 and 2018, there was a slight fall in the number of prescriptions. Now, the UK risks running into an opposite problem of doctors being too reluctant to give opioids to Cathy Strand, the pain specialist of the NHS Gloucestershire Clinical Commissioning Group. For people in long-term pain, there is no simple alternatives to opioids. For a while, it seemed the answer was a newer class of painkillers such as pegabalin, but the people again getting addicted to those too. Of course. This means opioids can be valuable for people who can take a low dose for a long time without developing tolerance, says Stannard. There are a small number of people for whom drugs is life-transforming. The proportion of people like this is unclear, but Stannard estimates it to be about 10%. 10%? What? A small number is 10%? My godfather. Yet some doctors are so alarmed of that small people, I suppose, maybe there's 10% with pain, and out of that 10% with pain, it's 10% of that. Yet some doctors are so alarmed at the prospect of the UK having its own addiction epidemic that they try to stop opioids for such individuals, says Leslie Coven, the University of Dundee, UK. Quote, everyone's saying you must not use opioids for chronic pain, but there is a group of people where they work reasonably well. Even people onto a higher dose shouldn't be made to quit unduly fast, or they will get withdrawal syndrome. If you're in horrible pain, that's fairly terrifying, like I tell you. The risks that people in pain turn to illegal drugs. When the US states clamped down on opioids requiring, fatal heroin overdoses surge. The prescribing was just stopped, says Coven. There was no additional support. Stannard, who advises clinicians on pain management, says a few family doctors have tried to ban long-term opioid use. I've had people saying to me, we're going to take everyone off opioids. Emma Scott Smith, an artist in Stirling, UK, who is on opioid painkillers for spinal pain, experiences this when she saw a different doctor for a usual one a few years ago. She told her she needed to come off the medication because she was an addict. She says, I was fearful because I knew my life depended on it. Without painkillers, she said, just moving is unbearable. So she was referred to a specialist who overturned her doctor, and she is now on long-term program to slowly lower her dose, although she believes she'll always need some painkillers to get out of her house to go to work. Stannard has also had a talk to hospital doctors out of ditching opioids for pain after surgery. That's a ridiculous knee-jerk response. Opioids are absolutely the best thing possibly post-operative pain. You betcha. In fact, I'm besides some of the pulling the movement pain, the opioids work brilliantly for me. UK doctors will soon get more help to tread the fine line between being too strict, too liberal with these medicines, because the various UK bodies are working on inquiries or guidelines on opiate use. A report on Public Health England is due out in a couple of months, while a spokesperson of the UK Medicines and Healthcare Products and Regulatory Agency says it is considering further moves, quote, to minimise the risk of inappropriate use while using the medicines that are available for those who need them, but declined to give specific details. Colony says Europe should learn lessons about opioids from the US, quote, we have known for a millennia that these are highly addictive, so it takes sense to be cautious as possible, he says. You need to tread very carefully to avoid following in our footsteps. For us, the genie's out of the bottle. So that's the UK. Working hypothesis. Sorting the week's supernova from Sub-Zero's Salvador Dali Museum. This is the man with the surrealist person. The Dali Museum in St. Petersburg, Florida, got an AI to study and archive footage of the great artist and create him as a deep and recreate him as deep fake. How surreal. That's beautiful. Spell check. Microsoft will help you mind your P's and Q's, and LGBTQ is a version of Office that checks documents for language, such as changing housewives to homemakers. Robot butlers are coming for robot. People are coming for robot jobs. Japanese startup Mirror Robotics will soon sell a robot butler. The catch is it's controlled remotely by a human. Space art. The orbital reflector, a piece of space art in the form of a shimmering balloon, has failed in orbit. Everyone's a critic. I don't understand it. Toothpaste. Charcoal-based toothpaste, which are black and don't whiten teeth, according to the US, is black and it doesn't whiten teeth. So that's 53 minutes. I'm just going to end it there and upload it.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.